And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
I am constant as the. I mean, I'm David.
Yes, there, I can't imagine where you got that reference from, David, or General Chang, as the case may be.
I feel like we're going to have an ongoing theme today, aren't we?
Perhaps. It may have had something to do with Shakespeare turning 450 a few weeks back on April 23rd.
Well, and you I don't thought, look a day over 300.
Yeah.
And I thought that since it's been said that when Star Trek doesn't have anything to say, it talks about Shakespeare, it would be good for us to do an episode on Shakespeare in Star Trek.
Shakes Trek in the Park?
You know, that would probably be good. You just do a Shakespeare play in Star Trek costumes. You know how they'll sometimes modernize Shakespeare plays? Just, you know, do the same thing, but with Trek costumes.
I thought that's what Undiscovered Country was.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that is basically what Undiscovered Country is. Although,
yeah.
Really, that's Conscience of the King. But we'll talk about that later, because I have two things I want to do before we do our main topic.
Okie dokie.
So, first is I want to put this to you guys. This was a question that came to my mind as I was listening to another Star Trek podcast, which is the 10 Forward podcast. For anyone who's interested, they are very good. But they were discussing episodes of Star Trek, and Measure of a Man came up. And one of their hosts said that Data's not a person. And then I got really ragey, and I don't remember the next few minutes. But when I came to my senses...
You had a rage blackout?
I might have.
Another one?
So, I didn't really agree with any of his arguments, but he did raise an interesting point, which was that if we consider Data to be a person, do we not have to consider the Enterprise computer to be a person? Because the Enterprise computer is aware of its environment and can... has sensors to detect its environment and can hold conversations, and if we consider the holodeck to be an extension of the computer, can even have very detailed conversations and simulate human emotions. So that was an interesting thought.
With that one episode, Emergence, I think it showed that it could reproduce. So, you know, is it a life form?
That's an interesting question. I'd say, the computer... It doesn't have a personality, and it doesn't have its own separate opinions as an entity from the ship or as an individual, so I don't think it really does.
Yeah, and that's something Bob and I had a fairly protracted conversation about this on Facebook, and I'm not going to try to read the whole thing because that would take a while, but Bob's thoughts on this matter were that the Enterprise computer is different than Data because the Enterprise computer doesn't have any desire really to be a person. Like, it does, you know, it can simulate limited conversation, but it doesn't come up with it doesn't think of anything. Like, it doesn't have the ability to spontaneously do things like where Data clearly does.
It's interesting to think, though, that in that case, ambition or like personal drive is the humanizing factor then.
Yeah, and Bob also made the argument that the holodeck doesn't count because holodeck characters are clearly separate from the computer. Like, the doctor has to use the computer like a regular crew member. Like, you know, he has to tap buttons. He can't just, you know, think and the computer does what he wants.
Right.
I'm a little
well,
bit...
But how does that relate to Moriarty? Moriarty was a holographic character who had sentience, who, you know, was stuck on the holodeck. He didn't have the emitter. But it wasn't the computer just treating it like a puppet, you know, just it was a sentient being. So, but the idea of, like, is Data a person and then is the Enterprise, quote, a person, to me, it's two separate things that we, you know, kind of go together, but it's still separate, is a life form, like the way some people bend thing the definitions to say, is fire a life form? But so there's life form and then there's sentient. And so, even though the Enterprise would be aware of its environment, the way like an amoebas could, you know, be aware of where food is or something, it would the Enterprise be sentient? But then again, is sentience required to be considered a person or a life form? So it's like a lot of back and forth on that.
You know, and it turns out that the distinction between, you know, sentience and not sentience is not clear, right? Like, right now, there's a lot of discussion that animals that we consume on a regular basis might meet the requirements for sentience, and so, you know, does that mean we have to stop eating them? Is a question that's been coming up more than a few times recently.
Damn, where's a philosophy major when we need one?
Yeah, And I think if nothing else, this is something that Star Trek has just not been prepared to deal with. Even if we don't consider the computer to have, you know, to be eligible for personhood, the fact that the computer can just create fully sentient and self-aware holograms if you ask it to is a implication that they never really understood the full meaning of.
Sentient or not, we really do not give the computer enough credit, I guess.
Well, the thing that just popped into my mind, like in a similar, like to carry on the discussion or the thought, the exocomps, we only saw them once, and I hoped they would be continued further, but we never saw them again. But they were shown to be sentient or, you know, self-aware. Would they have rights as person, you know, the personhood, the way we would attribute it to Data? I lean towards, yeah. I mean, just, you know, they're different, but still sentient.
Right. I remember seeing that episode and thinking that would have been a really great jumping off point for them to further explore that. It just never really happened.
Well, if you recall from the story, from the episode, A Measure of a Man, Bruce Maddox, excuse me, says, if it was a box on wheels, I wouldn't be facing this kind of opposition. And we saw in Exocomps that, which is not the name of the episode, but I don't remember what it was actually called, that he was actually right, because the Exocomps demonstrate the, you know, all the characteristics of sentience and sapience, but because they don't look like people, nobody but Data really takes them seriously at first.
So they only have to be android shaped in order for them to be taken seriously.
Although it should be pointed out that the other characters do come around to his point of view, right? Like they end the episode realizing, you know, Data, you're right, we have to extend them the same rights we would extend an organic life form. But he has to do a lot of convincing.
Right.
Well, not just organic life form, but I mean, it's like a limited view to think that you have to be shaped like a person or a human to be considered, you know, a life form.
That's anthropocentrism.
Right. I mean, we don't see it all that often in Trek, but look at, you know, the Undine, species 8472, then there's A-Rex on the animated, like, there's alien species out there that aren't two arms, two legs, and a head in our configuration. So
it's a real phrase they also use in anthropology and animal studies, anthropocentrism, where we imbue, you know, anthropomorphism is when we imbue human-like qualities on non-human things, because that makes them easier to identify with. So this is kind of a reverse thing, I guess? Dehuman them so we don't have to think about them as much?
Well,
right, just because they don't look like the, you know, form of... I mean, and to cross streams, I mean, look at Star Wars with their droids, whether their droids are sentient or, you know, considered a person like Data. They have all kinds of configurations of their robots and droids, and so it's just weird to think that, oh, you have to look like us with a head and two arms and two legs, then we'll take you serious.
Right. I mean, that's just a quirk of human biology, right, is that we're wired to recognize things that look like us because that made sense from a survival standpoint, but clearly the universe is bigger than that, right? So I thought it was interesting. It was an interesting question, and I do sometimes feel like the Enterprise computer is shown to be more intelligent than the crew is willing, you know, is willing to recognize, is because that would make the premise of the show somewhat difficult if they had to recognize the computer as a person.
That's true. We would get into kind of danger room territory, like what they had happen with the X-Men.
Yeah, that was where it got it gained sentience and got mad that all they used it for was a training room, right?
Yeah, and they also kind of established that it was sentient from the beginning, but Xavier's like, we're just going to ignore that so we can have our training room. And then,
not,
you know, sentience
a
gets
problem.
A body, decides to be a villain, like you do.
All right, so I just wanted to get your guys' thoughts on that. It was an interesting idea that had been raised. So we had an email from Data Logan last week, which was, as Data Logan's emails tend to be quite extensive. So I looked through it in the last couple of days and and decided on the points that I actually wanted to read out loud and the points that I thought could just be summarized. So here we go. The first he points out, we were talking about Dukat's first name in our Cardassian episode, and he points out that in A Time to Stand, we learned that Dukat has the initials SG, which I'd forgotten about. And in the books, his name is identified as Skrein, which is, yeah, I'd say that fits, Skrein Dukat.
Sounds villainous, yeah.
He also pointed out that when I was talking about females in the Cardassian military, I forgot to mention Gull Asset from the TNG's The Chase, and that is true. I did forget to mention her, so thank you, Data, for pointing that out.
Right, the pigtailed Klingon, Cardassian.
Yeah. For anyone who doesn't remember, The Chase is the episode where it's revealed that they're all actually derived from some sort of progenitor race that looked like a changeling and went around scattering, you know, DNA on different planets, which is kind of a strange concept, but, you know, they were trying to explain why everyone looks like a person with a weird thing on their forehead, so I'll cut them some slack.
Plot ex machina.
Yeah, you know how it is. This next part I will read aloud. You guys stated Star Trek does the best job of doing non-human or alien world building, and then he put an exclamation mark and a question mark at the end of that, but I'm not going to try to pronounce those things. And he said, I would argue Interrobang!
Interrobang!
Which is probably the coolest word that anyone's ever made. I would argue that Farscape...
We're going to get questioned on that, too.
I would argue that Farscape and maybe Babylon 5 have done it better, though I still prefer Trek for other reasons. Well, I would argue differently, sir, but that's partly because I don't think Farscape did a very good job of building a consistent or interesting universe, but that was just my opinion, and this is not all things Farscape. So we are not going to have that debate here today. Scrolling down here. Point 4. I think it was established that medical advances would make pregnancy and labor less traumatic, mentioned in Deep Space Nine's What You Leave Behind and TNG's The Child and Data's Day. But some people like Cassidy Yates still choose to do it the natural way. And then he goes on to share a personal story. When my astrophysicist wife had our first child, she did so without drugs. She trained herself to use hypnosis and put herself in a trance, with some cues and support by me, that allowed her to experience what she wanted to experience and ignore sensations she did not want to experience. The power of the mind. I should mention, though, in all fairness, that it didn't work so well with the second child, in which case a difficult labor and inducing drugs overpowered her hypnotic abilities. Which I think is really cool. Good for your wife, Data Logan, if she can do that. I don't think I could, but then again, I'll never be in a position to find out.
Mind over matter can do crazy things.
Well, and in that episode, we talked about advancements of medicine and technology, you know, inducing. But then that just made me think all you would really need is a Vulcan midwife. Just, you know, use the mind meld, put them in like a trance, you know, take their mind off of it or join. That'd be weird, but cool.
Yeah, totally. He points out we'd been wondering what happened to Ogawa's child, and at one point we'd speculated that she might have lost it. We weren't sure, but he says that Ogawa did not lose her child. It just doesn't appear again after that episode. But in the books, sometimes they have one book where they say she had a daughter, but in the others she's considered to have had a son because I guess there was not communication on that subject.
It was a transporter accident, which we don't talk about it too much.
He goes on to mention on the subject of Julia Taynor, Data's mom. He writes, I don't think Julia Taynor's android shutdown was ever meant to be permanent. I think Sung's idea was that she would have one normal life, then after her natural death, she would reawaken as a droid and start a new life, probably after changing her skin and self to look younger, because why not? I'm not sure that was the implication of that episode, Data Logan. I haven't seen it for a while, but it's possible. That's not how I remember it, but it shows that maybe I need to do a TNG rewatch. It's been a while.
If not, it makes for a good headcanon.
That's true. And they do bring up that character again in some of the books that feature Data, because, you know, one of the big things the books have done since Nemesis is resurrect Data, because no one really wanted Data to be dead.
Well, especially the Cold Equations trilogy by David Mack that really delves into Data and pretty much every android connected with Data. So, yeah.
He also takes us to task for not mentioning Carol and David Marcus in our Motherhood in Star Trek episode, which is fair. We totally should have talked about them. We actually ran out of time. We had lots of other things on our notes that we didn't have time to talk about. That was one of them, believe it or not, Data. But I appreciate you are correct. He also mentions that this is like the only situation in Star Trek where we saw someone willingly choose to have sex and get pregnant outside of wedlock. Like in every other instance, they're always either getting married, already married, or it was non-consensual. So I thought that was interesting, and it's a good point, and I wish we'd had time to talk about it when we did the episode.
We'll save it for next Mother's Day.
No doubt. We certainly have more ground we could cover on that subject.
Oh, yes.
So on to our main topic for today, as we have said, is Shakespeare in Star Trek.
Even I had a question for our topic. Are we really going to be mentioning only Shakespeare as depicted on Star Trek, or also, I think like what me and Grace were thinking could also be interesting is just Shakespeare's effect on Star Trek, like when, You know, even episodes that use the themes or scenarios but don't actually use a quote. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, totally. I'm not just saying we should only talk about the Shakespeare quotes. I don't think that would actually be a very interesting podcast. I actually wanted to start, if you guys don't mind, just talking about Shakespeare outside of Star Trek and like
absolutely.
You know, what your favorite Shakespeare piece of work is and why. Since I've got my hand on the talk button, I'll go ahead and go first, if you guys don't mind. I think my favorite Shakespeare work is that I've seen, there are some that I haven't seen, much to my chagrin, is Othello. And that could be because I saw a really good production of it with Shakespeare in the Park, but I really, really like the dynamic between Othello, the main character, and Iago, the villain. I think that they have a really interesting, you know, there's the power play between them is really cool. And I think that Othello is a great character. And I think Midsummer Night's Dream is probably a close second, because I could watch Midsummer Night's Dream all day.
And do you have a favorite Shakespeare quote?
There's so many to choose from. I honestly think I might have to go with To Be or Not to Be. I know it's a bit corny, but I really like it. I like the subtext, and I like the extended quote, which I'm actually bad at remembering exactly, but you know, whether to suffer the slings and arrows or what have you.
It is a good oldie but a goodie. And what about you? What about you, David? Do you have a favorite work of Shakespeare?
I haven't read all of Shakespeare, unfortunately, but growing
who
up,
who has?
Right, exactly. Growing up,
let's be
actually,
real here.
It was in school where they, for the first time, I was exposed to Romeo and Juliet. And it was one of the times where, you know, it was like a AP English or whatever, and it was, oh, we're going to watch a movie today. And some people were like, yay, I get to put my head down and not think. Other people were just like, you know, oh, it's TV. And some people liked it, but that was the first time I had, like, seen the whole plot, the whole story of Romeo and Juliet. And I thought, like, it just really intrigued me, and I wanted to read it after that. And, you know, it was the actual movie that was done with Olivia Hussey, and it was like, oh, you know, are we going to show this in class? And it was like no big deal. But so that was the first, you know, impact that I had. And then later on, I, you know, enjoying more of it. I like, basically, I think I would have to go with Hamlet on it for a couple different reasons, but also because it's been translated or restored into the original Klingon, and I have that book in hardcover. And then it was, you know, published in a paperback. So, yeah, there's a lot of good ones. It's hard to pick a favorite.
So, Grace?
Well, I feel like, you know, you're obligated to say Hamlet because it's the most, you know, sort of critically popular one. But I'm going to play wild card here and say Titus Andronicus is a personal favorite. Not just because it is the grisliest and darkest of the plays, but also it's really fun to kind of explain the plot of that one and be like, oh yeah, it's Shakespeare. This is old school classical. This is the stuff that our kids are learning in school. And just sort of be like, yeah, we think of the classics as this very, you know, what am I trying to say? We'd like to think of them as this very sort of elegant, very sophisticated kind of thing. But sometimes it's just, nope, it's all just blood and guts and revenge. And it gets grisly as hell.
And I mean, go ahead.
It's a really fun example of how the Shakespeare at its time was, you know, stuff for the people. Just so much of it was driven by this idea of give the people what they want to see. And Titus Andronicus is such a great example of that.
Well, as has been pointed out many times on the internet, Shakespeare was competing with, like, hangings and bear baitings, right, for his audience. And you could be very wealthy if you got a dollar for every, like, dirty joke that is in a lot of the different Shakespeare plays.
Right. I just love that Titus Andronicus is such a great example of that and such a great reminder of that when we think of Shakespeare as the end-all, be-all of high class. It's just a wonderful reminder, and it's also just a really good sort of Greek tragedy-style story, and it's just, it can be done very interestingly if you see it done by the right people. And I'm also going to say Macbeth is a personal favorite just because it's one of the great Shakespeare tragedies, and it's just one of the fun historical ones also.
Yeah, Macbeth is really, really good.
Great. You mentioned, you know, the dirty jokes and other stuff like that. It was in school at some point, but it was interesting to me to find out, and you could correct me or, you know, add more to it. But that, at, you know, we look at Shakespeare as like the height of art and you know, great
yeah.
writing and everything. But it was weird to me to learn that at the time, he didn't get that same level of respect. And some people thought that he was kind of writing almost what would be like summer action blockbusters with explosions
right.
and, you know, all that. And so it was just weird, you know, in school, I was like, oh, they didn't think of him like Mozart at the time where everybody's like, you're a genius, we love you. Like that back then, people were like, oh, here goes Shakespeare again with his type, you know. And then all this years later, we look at it as, you know, such high art. But, but Grace, do you have a favorite quote?
I do. And it's neither a borrower nor a lender be. Because it sounds very bland. And, you know, for like a great grand writer like Shakespeare, where you've got all this great stuff with metaphor and iambic pentameter and just all this very beauty-based lyricism, it's just a piece of good advice. Don't get involved in what you don't need to get involved in. Just keep your nose clean. Neither a borrower nor a lender be.
Yep.
And Shakespeare's scathing critique of modern capitalist economy.
It's not a critique, it's just pragmatic.
Well, Oren stole my quote in a way, but actually I prefer the original Klingon version, which is tach par tach be, which is, you know, to survive or not to survive, or, you know, to be or not to be.
With 100% more guttural throat sounds.
Exactly.
Because if you're a Klingon, it's not enough to just be. You have to survive. You have to earn that being, I guess.
So with that little talk about our, like, actual Shakespeare, I wanted to bring up I was looking at the list of Memory Alpha, like, Shakespeare references, and most of them are like, you know, in this episode, Picard makes a reference to Hamlet, and in this episode, they read a Macbeth quote. But most of them are pretty, like, you know, are just that, right? They're just quotes. But one thing that I thought...
Quotes
and really...
episode titles.
Yeah, and lots of episode titles, oh god. But one thing that I think is interesting is we actually see a couple of times, we see Data studying Shakespeare as part of learning about humanity, and I'd like to get your guys' thoughts on that.
Well, again, I think that part of what Data would find interesting about that is that, on one hand, it is considered this height of civilization and this great piece of work, this great example of writing, and such a cultural impact it's had. But at the same time, it's, again, a really good example of just sort of like the blood, the guts, the melodrama, the over-the-top romance, all of the stuff that people just like to see. So it's got that bread and circuses quality to it of this is what people find interesting and this is what people find fascinating. This is what people want to hear about and like to talk about. So in a sense, it expresses both the higher thinking intellectual side of humanity and also the, oh, I want to hear what this craziness side of humanity, the I want to say gossipy, but that's not quite right. The part of humanity that just really likes a good show.
Yeah, the more visceral reactions, right? Because on the one
exactly,
hand, a lot,
yeah.
you know, Shakespeare plays do ask us really important questions and make us like wonder, you know, what is our place in the world and why are we doing what we're doing? But they'll also, of course, have universal draw, or they wouldn't still be performed today, right? So
right.
I think that's interesting. I think Data using Shakespeare to learn what humanity is all about, there is definitely truth to that, because if there wasn't something about Shakespeare that rung true for us, we wouldn't still be watching these plays that are in a language that you need like special training to understand properly.
It's supposed to be our language and everything.
Well, it's like it's almost like its own dialect, right? Because like that's not Elizabethan
yeah.
English they're using. That's like, you know, Shakespeare invented his own dialect of English for his plays, which is pretty, as I believe, is consistent across his work. I could be wrong about that. I'm not a Shakespeare scholar.
Well, and I've heard people, obviously, you know, some people prefer watching the movies because, you know, in a way that you could just see it and the actors may change, they may change dialogue, but it's just in some ways easier to comprehend it if you see it and hear it as opposed to reading it. Because I've heard some people say they wanted to read a Shakespeare, even some of the sonnets and shorter works, but then they just can't get past the language. Like, you know, they're not seeing the forest because the trees in the way. Whereas other people, I've heard that that's like the draw. Like they like it because there's this, almost in a way, I've seen some people mention like with the Klingon language or now with the other, you know, Dothraki from Game of Thrones. It's ooh, the exotic. Like, you know, if it's just the same story written in a novel of today's type language, that would be one thing. But some people in like actually like that, ooh, it feels different, it feels exotic, and you know, you have to kind of work at it a little bit to, in a way I think that's, you know, a cool thing about Shakespeare, that it's, you know, not just old timey talk, but it's a unique style of Shakespeare.
You also got to wonder if that's part of what the long-standing appeal of Shakespeare was, that there's a level of otherness and exoticism to it, but at the same time, it's still very Western, if that's part of what's kept it consistent in Western's cultural canon.
Right, and that is one thing that I wish we had seen a little bit more of with Data, was that whenever he's studying to learn more about humanity, it's like he's studying to learn more about Western European and American humanity. There's,
well, of course, the guy's right in the show.
You know, there's a little bit more to humanity than that, it turns out. But so there
is
that.
He got to be
part
of a Japanese wedding, and that was about it.
That's true. Although Shakespeare has crossed cultural lines to a certain extent. I mean, there are a number of like
there are universal stories in some way that people are just find interesting.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite adaptations of Shakespeare is Ron, which was Kurosawa's adaptation of King Lear. Which I actually like better than the original.
Classic.
I really enjoy watching Ron. So that, you know, that's a case of it crossing a cultural boundary, which I think is really interesting. And I also think that David, you were talking about the languages. I think that it's one of those things where watching Shakespeare in the original, you know, Shakespearean English, and then watching remakes that are the same story, but are more understandable. I think both of those have a lot of value to them. Like West Side Story is a really great retelling of Romeo and Juliet. But I also feel that actually watching Romeo and Juliet is also important.
Yeah, again, the thing about Shakespeare is they've got these universally interesting stories, which also give them all great adaptability. So we get to see them run the gamut culturally so much adaptation-wise. And one of my personal favorites, it probably isn't an actual adaptation, but a bunch of parallels were drawn when it first came out, was with The Fast Runner, which is an Inuit-based story about, you know, murder and revenge and spirits. And it's a really good movie. It's one of the ones that I think everyone should see at least once. And it's got some very Shakespearean tragedy elements to it. And it's really cool to think of those as the universal things that we'd like to see in stories and that we find interesting and that have kind of permeated every culture in their own way. And it's also funny how we consider those Shakespearean when they're a universal thing. Like maybe it was Shakespeare who first brought them into Western canon and made them like widely accessible through his plays in a way that people could just, you know, go and see them and have something to talk about. And there's something that they were very widespread, and there's something that everyone can at least say they have a passing knowledge of. And it's just so interesting.
Or at the very least, Shakespeare was the first one who managed to get the, you know, the patronage of a monarch in order to do it. Right.
That helps. Yeah.
Because part of the reason Shakespeare is so widely known is because Queen Elizabeth was like, yeah, I like those plays. You should do more of them, Shakespeare. It'd be great.
It's good to have fans in high places.
And what was the name of the movie you mentioned again? I'd like to check
it out.
The
Fast Runner. It's an Inuit movie. Well, Inuit-based.
Right.
Check it out. It's good stuff.
So on the topic of Star Trek, the first episode that I wanted to look at was Emergence. Because this one I was a little puzzled by, honestly. I know that it starts with Data doing a performance of The Tempest on the holodeck. And it is also the last holodeck episode that they did in TNG. So it was like Brendan Braga, who of course really loves holodeck episodes. You'd never guess from watching Voyager.
What?
But he
I'm
really,
shocked.
Yeah. So he wanted to do a big holodeck farewell episode, which is why they use the holodeck to go to like 10 different places in that episode. It's the, for anyone who doesn't remember, Emergence is the episode where the Enterprise computer starts, like, creates a new life form and sends it off into space. Now, and according to some sources that I've read, Emergence is paralleled with the Tempest. And Like, I don't know. I wanted to know if you guys thought that. Like, because after watching The Tempest and watching Emergence, I'm not exactly seeing it. Like, there are references to The Tempest, but the story in Emergence feels very different.
Well, there are some themes that definitely run parallel. Like you're talking about the creation of a new life form and rebirth and sort of shrugging off the old life are both really big themes in The Tempest, along with just being a stranger in a strange land, which ultimately is what the holodeck is. And that's kind of the appeal for most of the characters, isn't it? To experience this sense of otherness right at home. So that could be part of it. That's what I got anyway. It's been
Fair
a long
enough.
time since I've seen that episode.
Yeah, it's been a while. David, what do you think?
I think, that when watching it, I didn't think of The Tempest, but now that, that's brought up, I could kind of see it, but yeah, I didn't think of that at the time.
Now, another episode that I was looking at, which I think really well encapsulates the Star Trek message, or not the Star Trek message, the Shakespeare parallel. And this is actually a movie, not an episode, but Star Trek VI is all about Shakespeare,
Yeah.
right? And
Oh,
like, I mean,
yeah.
that's the one where we get all the Shakespeare quotes. Like during the last battle, Chang is just yelling Shakespeare quotes, which kind of makes me wonder why they
The
have a
title
radio.
itself is a Hamlet reference, isn't it?
It is the Undiscovered Country.
Referring to death as the undiscovered country.
And it kind of makes you.
In the movie, and they actually say, we hear the line or the phrase "the undiscovered country" in the show. I mean, in the movie, and I kind of I liked it how they handled it because Gorkon makes the toast like to the undiscovered country, and then there's like that pause, like everybody's looking around, like wait a minute, and he's like the future, so he kind of twists it.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's definitely the reference to that
Again, that's the
Hamlet
beauty of
line.
Shakespeare, though, the adaptability of so much of it and the way that it can be twisted and interpreted and the way many people can use it to their own means. And maybe that's what the Klingons like about it.
And with this movie, I remember reading it might even be on Memory Alpha, but I remember like in some of the behind the scenes stuff, they thought like, are we putting too many Shakespeare quotes into this? And then they thought, well, come on, it's like a total Shakespeare, the title, the plot, like this is the time to go Shakespeare crazy with especially with Chang, and going off in his tangent.
Right, we get some great monologues that are very Shakespearean. We get to see Kirk even have a soliloquy when he's by himself in his room, recording his personal log. And again, I think that's one of the continuing sort of Shakespearean themes or old school theatrical themes that we get throughout all of the different versions of Star Trek. We get the captain's log or the personal log, which gets to serve as a personal soliloquy and usually the introduction that we get to the episode. And the basis of, well, this is what's going on right now, and it's very soliloquy-y. And that's just a really cool way to use sort of a theatrical device in a not so theatrical setting, and I really love that. And I think they use it to great effect in Undiscovered Country, especially with the theme of, oh, my soliloquy, it hath been heard, sort of when Valeris shows up.
I
It's
didn't
very
even think of
Shakespearean.
that, but that's a very good point. I mean, Star Trek VI makes really good use of the captain's log, which I sometimes find a little bit goofy, but I
Again,
think
it's a soliloquy. That's essentially what it is.
that's true. And I really like the play with on the worse, not the worse, excuse me, the meaning of the title, The Undiscovered Country, because, as David, as you pointed out, in the original play, The Undiscovered Country refers to death, and the idea is that no one ever comes back from death. That's, the final destination. But it also works for the future, because you don't come back from the future unless you're going to do a slingshot around the sun, and that's in a different movie entirely.
Or you've got a DeLorean.
Yeah, that'll work too. But or a TARDIS or what have you. But it's the
More
same.
often than not, you do not come back from the future.
Your most people are not going to come back from the future. And in that same movie, you have the themes of there are people who think that the future is death. Like the future that Gorkon envisions for them, they see it as the worst thing that could possibly happen, which is why you have that whole conspiracy to assassinate him and destroy the peace talks.
Well, they
And
even say that or give voice to that at that banquet table when it was Kurla, I think was he says like we all know where this is going, or I think it was him, but in that banquet it was like we know where this is headed, meaning a ceasing of hostilities and cooperation and all that, meaning if they were to join the Federation, like an end to their culture. And that's where, you know, they're like, that's not true. And it's like, well, you're a Homo sapiens only club and all that. But that does show, like, in their mind, they weren't thinking of physical death of their bodies, but, like, the death of their culture.
Yeah, it would be, you know, we would get peace, but at what cost, I think, was what they were asking. Like, you know, would we need to... They had this idea that the Federation was offering them help, but, you know, it was the help where you have to be exactly like us. It's like, sure, we'll help you with
like
that.
Like, conform or die, kind of.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, we'll help you with that moon problem you've got, but only if you put down the Batleths, or they didn't have Batleths at the time, but, you know, only if you stop with the whole warrior thing, because, yeah, that's, who wants that, right?
That shtick is going nowhere, thank you very much.
But, I mean, fortunately, we saw that that wasn't true, because Star Trek is usually about cultural inclusiveness, but it's still, it's a very powerful theme, and I really like the way that it plays against, if you know a lot about Shakespeare, it makes the story much richer for you. And if you don't know a lot about Shakespeare, it still works, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And also, the whole plot of the movie is very Shakespearean. The ideas of tenuous peace and backhanded and under-the-table politics, those are very Shakespearean. Those are straight out of his political ones and the historical plays. And they use it to really good effect. Again, I think if any story was going to be the Shakespearean one, it wouldn't be the big fantastical over-the-top one. It would be the one where it's all about internal politics and the dirty dealings that come with that. And I just love that that we get to see them going in that direction. And we still get a few shoot-em-ups. We still get some of the action and all that. But it really is all about the compromise and the dealing that comes with peace, that you need for peace, and the compromises that come with it. And there will be people who just, for their own reasons, have no desire for peace. And again, it's very Shakespearean. Even the big reveal of the disguising identity thing comes straight out of the mistaken identity stuff that Shakespeare does. And that was that. They used so many of the tropes effectively and in this movie, which is probably why it's one of my favorites.
Was also just really, really good.
That too, and Iman is in it, which is just awesome.
Well, speaking of her character, for a long time I didn't realize that she actually quoted Shakespeare, because there's the line from Hamlet, I thought I would assume a pleasing shape. I just, you know,
right,
think,
yeah.
Oh yeah, she's a shapeshifter. I didn't make that connection, but looking at the Memory Alpha entry, it says Chang, who was, you know, spouting quotes, that he quoted from Romeo and Juliet, Henry the Fourth, Richard II, Henry V, Julius Caesar, The Tempest, Merchant of Venice, and Hamlet. So that's a lot of, you know, source material to quote from.
The guy is well read, okay? I also think what we learned in Star Trek VI is that Uhura is a huge Shakespeare fan, because she just left the radio on for Chang to quote Shakespeare at them. Like, you know, because that was one thing that I was wondering about. I was like, why can they still hear him? Do they just have an open channel that nobody has turned off?
Again, soliloquying. Sometimes you just need an audience, I guess. But I'm also wondering about Iman's character. Her name is totally escaping me right now, and I'm embarrassed about that. But
Martia.
And the whole thing on the prison planet, it's very separate from the whole political thriller aspect of the story. And her character kind of feels like it comes out of nowhere and just lives in this separate aspect of the film, of the prison planet and that story there. But it kind of makes me wonder, with her sort of subplot is where we get like all of the kind of goofy, the bawdy, the sexy of the movie. And it makes me wonder if she doesn't serve as kind of the Falstaffian figure of the movie. Not in the like over the top and, you know, slobbish way, but just in the, this is the lighter part that is casting the darker parts in more sort of stark contrast.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably true to at least a certain extent. I mean, the whole prison planet part of the story is basically to put Kirk in a little bit more of his natural element one last time, right?
Right.
Because like, the whole, like, the movie
Kirk
series
is not a character that was built for the political thriller, essentially.
No, not really. And part of the, and like, he can work in it, but part of the thing that was going on with the movies was that they were slowly moving further and further away from Kirk as, like, you know, an action, a rough and tumble action star. and moving him more and more as into being like an academic character, or maybe not academic, but a more intellectual character, more like Picard, basically.
Right, and that feels like it goes along with the sort of progressive theme that they have going with the later movies of them just saying, yeah, Kirk is getting old. Kirk is growing up and growing a little wiser bit by bit. And I think that this movie reflects that very well. And what better way to say getting wiser than with a butt ton of Shakespeare references?
Right. And with the prison sequence, that was like their one, since it was going to be the last movie with Kirk in it, they were like, this is our one last Kirk going on his one final, like, rough and tumble fist fight.
That was
adventure.
Their last hurrah, yeah.
Yeah, and it also, of course, is to give Spock the chance to really act as the commanding officer, right? He has to step up and make all the important decisions.
And so, if you're going to have anyone, you know, representing your good guys in such a argument-based plot, then you really do want Spock in charge. You want the guy who's all about logic to be running the show.
That's true. Now, it's been also been pointed out a number of times that the episode Ilan of Troyes is sort of a Star Trek remake of Taming of the Shrew. Now, I've never seen Taming of the Shrew.
I have.
Grace David. Oh, so you've seen it, Grace.
I have, but I haven't seen the episode. So if you could sort of reiterate it.
Okay. Well, here.
Taming of the Shrew well, and I can both sing its praises and condemn it to hell and back.
Maybe if we bang our heads together really hard, the knowledge will transfer over and we'll both know what we need to know.
Yeah, let's go for it.
All right, so Ilan of Troyes is a somewhat problematic episode because they have, basically the plot is that they have to transport the Ilan of Troyes, who is this very attractive lady in a very, shall we say, sparse costume.
Obviously a Helen of Troy reference also with the name.
Yeah. And they have to transport her from her home planet to this other planet where she will be married, and that will stop a war that's been happening. But the conflict arises in that she's basically a spoiled child type character. And it's like Kirk has to sort of teach her manners, or at least, like, you know, calm her down so she can accept her responsibilities. And so there are a number of really questionable, like, that, you know, borderline misogynist scenes where it's like, you know, this is a you see like a man asserting control over a woman who like is clearly not interested, and so that's really like
that sounds very Taming of the Shrew.
Yeah,
well, I just looked it up. I put the link to it in for Memory Alpha into the chat room, and I looked to the background story production type stuff. And it does say, obviously, Helen of Troyes reference, but then it says, the story is a science fiction version of Shakespeare's plays The Taming of the Shrew and Antony and Cleopatra, and that was apparently written first in the old Star Trek compendium. Do you see that, the other aspects of the other play in that?
Well, there's there's the proud woman theme that goes with both of them. Obviously, you know, if you're Cleopatra, you've got some chutzpah, but what am I trying to say here? The main themes are both of this woman who is holier than thou and the guy who needs to essentially knock her down a couple pegs to get on the level with her. Of course, it's very different with Taming of the Shrew, where the basis for that story, if you're not familiar with it, is a wealthy man has two daughters. He can't marry off the younger daughter until he marries off the older one. And while the younger one is very sweet and personable and very, you know, dutiful, the older one is very catty, very very loud, very brash, and will not suffer fools lightly. So they decide they're going to find a husband for her who will, you know, put her in her place, which is hardly the best moral that you want to see. And it's hardly the best kind of female representation that you want to see, that the character is supposed to be strong and willful and that that's a bad thing. But very clearly her character does very nasty things and says very nasty things, but it just adds more to this idea that those are negative traits in a woman. Whereas with Antony and Cleopatra, she's willful, she's strong, but she's not nasty to people, at least in the same way that Kat from Taming of the Shrew is. And, you know, she's supposed to be royal and regal, and it's more of a battle of the wits with Antony and Cleopatra that's more on equal footing rather than with Taming the Shrew, it's just about putting the woman in her place.
Yeah, the episode of Lawn of Troyes also throws in a kind of random plot twist where it turns out that the women of the Alon's planet, their tears basically make you love them. And so
Well, isn't that convenient?
it is, isn't it? And so, Kirk, she cries on Kirk a little bit, and then Kirk has, goes all lovey-dovey, and then that's like his conflict for the episode. And like there are some good parts in it. If I would recommend Jarrah Hodge's review of it over on Trekkie Feminist. She, points out that there are some good things and there are also a lot of bad things. It's hard to watch from a modern perspective and not be all like, ugh, really? Ugh.
Which is the same with Taming of the Shrew and, to some degree, Anthony and Cleopatra.
Which I know even less about. I did. I like if you'd said that to me, I wouldn't have realized it was the title of a play, because I'm terrible.
No one knows about the historicals. So it's kind of a unwritten law of Shakespeare. No one knows, no one really cares.
But let me tell you one that the last thing I have on my list that I really enjoy, then that I can talk about is The Conscience of the King,
Oh yeah, let's go all up in that.
which is a really interesting Star Trek take on Hamlet. Because, so for anyone who doesn't remember, the plot of The Conscience of the King is that there is an actor who's part of a Shakespearean theater company who Kirk's old friend believes is actually Kodos the Executioner, who is infamous for having ordered the unnecessary culling of half of his colony because he thought that was the only way to keep the other half alive.
And didn't they say it was like 4 million people or something like
Four
that?
thousand.
4,000, okay.
And just to make it extra creepy and reference the Nazis, he also did it for eugenics reasons because he decided that the more, desirable half of the colony would get to live and the less desirable half would not. And since apparently there were only like 9 people who had ever seen him after that, I'm guessing one trait that made you less desirable was having seen Kodos the Executioner. You shouldn't be allowed to pass that on to your children.
You shouldn't be able to allowed to pass judgment on Kodos unless he's passed judgment on you.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the plot, is that they is Kodos is supposed to be dead, but no one really knows for sure. Kirk's friend is one of the people who has seen Kodos, and even though they have a picture of him, they're still really obsessed with the eyewitness thing. So Kirk has to like try to figure out if this guy actually is Kodos, and it's the whole episode is a giant Hamlet parallel because, in Hamlet you have the title character Hamlet spends the whole play, or not maybe not the whole play, but a lot of the play trying to
Most of the
figure
play,
out
yeah.
if his uncle Claudius is the uncle's name, right?
That's right,
Claudius?
yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
if Claudius killed his father. And that's part of what the play is famous for, is that he has to be absolutely certain. Like even when it gets to the point where really the audience has all figured out, yeah, Claudius killed your father.
Right,
You're
he gets a visit from the ghost of his father, essentially telling him what happened, and he's still gotta be like, I've got to know for sure. Just to be 1000% sure.
Yeah, and that you see the
Which is
same thing.
actually kind of what gives Hamlet his moral redeemability, his desire to not just go and decide that this is the right answer and to kill him. And that's one of the few morally redeeming qualities that Hamlet gets throughout the play.
You also see that,
Action-wise, at least.
yeah, totally. And you see that same thing with Kirk, which is a little bit unusual for Kirk because at one point Spock even says, "This guy is Kodos. I can prove it." And Kirk's like, "But we're not 100%. Like, we have to be 100% before we accuse this man of being Kodos the Executioner," which is,
Well, I'm sorry I'm interrupting, but
No, go ahead.
I think in this case that assigning that trait and that characteristic to Kirk is what makes him sort of the Shakespearean hero in this story. That's imbuing him with one of the heroic Shakespearean traits, and it gives him a better place in the Shakespearean story, I think.
Right, and I'm willing to accept it, even though normally I don't think Kirk would act like that, because if I was going to give Kirk a trait, it would not be thinks before, thinks too much, right? He's
Again, though, that's the purpose that Kirk would need to serve in this story. And it's weird because in Undiscovered Country, we see him do kind of the opposite, don't we?
Yeah, although in this context, I think it really works because you have to understand that in this episode, they reveal that Kirk's backstory is almost that he lived through the Holocaust. Like
something like that, yeah.
Which is a incredibly
dark...
Let's
not draw parallels like that, though.
Which is an incredibly dark backstory that he doesn't, you know, that they never really bring up again. But in this episode, that's his backstory. So it makes sense that he would feel differently about this than he would about other things. Like, I can accept that he would perform this action differently than he would anything else, just because he has all of that emotional and you know, perhaps physical trauma that he's carrying around with him in regards to it.
Right, yeah.
And so, you know, and I find that very interesting that he spends the episode like being, you know, he's constantly confronted with evidence that this man is Kodos, and then being like, but that's not enough. I need more. And
well, with that, sorry, yeah, go ahead. Keep going.
I was just going to say, to a certain extent, it does start to make you feel like that he doesn't want him to be Kodos. Like he has this, he's in his mind, he's filed this under case closed. You know, Kodos died. That part of history is over. And if Kodos is still alive, then, you know, he's going to have to deal with that all over again. He's going to have to choose whether or not, like, what's he going to do with Kodos if he is alive? Is he going to hand him over to Federation, you know, security? Is he going to let the justice system take its course? Go ahead.
Sorry. I think that actually adds kind of to the Macbeth parallels that we see a lot of in this episode also. There are a lot of them. For one, there's the theme of, no, I've got to have more. With Kirk, it's evidence. With Macbeth, it's power. And the whole being haunted by the past and being haunted by uncertainty is another thing that happens in Macbeth. We see Macbeth kill some people and then get haunted by them and just be stuck with this kind of, oh, wow, this isn't going to leave me alone. I'm stuck with this sense. And also there's the Lady Macbeth thing, obviously. We have our beautiful young actress in the theater troupe, Lenore, who, when we first meet her, we're kind of introduced to her as Lady Macbeth. But then, you know, as an actress who has played the character, and at first it seems kind of like we're just getting that as establishing that she's a very good actress, she's learned very well from her dad. But then later on, spoiler alert, we get the big reveal that it's actually her who has been killing off survivors and getting rid of the people who could place her father at the massacre and place him as Kodos, that she's been doing it all for him. And that's very Lady Macbeth right there. So we get to see her both as someone who has represented the character as Lady Macbeth and in the Lady Macbeth role in the story.
Well, and interestingly, the episode starts with that theater company performing Macbeth.
Right, and, that too, yeah. With the death of Duncan.
Yep.
And
then he gives the quote, you know. So it was, yeah, I definitely enjoyed all the layers to this episode.
And they're also, like, with that character, with Lenora, most of her scenes are very, you know, classic Kirk love interest, right? Where she's being a little coy, but is clearly interested in him. And then, like, they do the soft focus shot where they put some Vaseline on the lens, you know, like you did back in the day.
And then we get it switched around at the end that she's playing him.
Yeah. And, like, she goes completely nuts and
Yeah,
and is a very powerful performance. Like, when I was watching her do that in the last scene, I was like, oh, God, look at those eyes. Those eyes. So, you know, props to the actress for that. That was a very powerful performance.
It's a great performance, both in the sense that she is, she does very well as the archetypical Kirk love interest. Then she gets to turn that whole thing on its head, absolutely, and then she gets to go insane. And we get to see her do all three very well. And it adds to the episode so well.
Like, another very interesting performance is the actor who plays Kodos. Because he's obviously done Shakespeare before. Like,
yeah,
he was a
stage performer, yeah. So that's really his bread and butter that we get to see him doing there. And that permeates his performance very well. So we get to see Kodos do some monologuing and some moral questioning. And it just reflects very well on him as an actor and on this story as a Shakespearean story. Or at least Shakespearean-based.
Yeah, and I think that his acting is very important because what he's saying is actually, if you listen to it, is a little bit nonsensical. Like, when Kirk confronts him about being Kodos, he basically says, well, I might be Kodos, but really, it happened a long time ago. So
When I just watched it a little bit ago, when he first walks in, Kirk just outright says, "Are you Kodos?" And then he says, like, "Do you believe I am?" And Kirk says, "Yes." And he's like, "Well, then I am, because you believe it. I'm such a great actor." And then it goes on from there. So I was like, well, you know, it was just interesting that he would have went in that direction with, you know, I'll be almost like, I'll be whoever because I'm such a great actor and I'll make you believe it or whatever. But it was the whole episode was like really well acted, like, you know, different than a lot of Trek because they're being Shakespearean on a lot of levels.
Well, with the character also, I feel like we kind of establish at that point when he's saying, yes, this is the role I'm playing, this is who I can be, that's sort of how he's compartmentalized the things he's done in the past and been like, this is the past, this right. is who I am now, this is the life I have now, this is my daughter who is part of this new life, and I want her to have nothing to do with the old one. Sort of like it's just more roles he's taken on that he can switch in and out of so he doesn't have to be that person anymore.
They do sort of imply that he actually had forgotten that he was Kodos. Like, it's subtle, but there are a couple of lines that indicate that he doesn't actually remember if he's Kodos or not.
Or maybe he's just old and crazy.
Yeah, I mean, and that could be a combination of either he might be suffering from some kind of memory disability, or it could be, you know, just trauma. People have been known to edit their memories in really, you know, extreme ways to, you know, when they remember traumatic events. And
well,
obviously,
and that kind of ties into a scene where, like, at the end, we kind of see that it was when what was that guy? The guy that gets poisoned and get behind the scenes.
Riley,
you know, around that time, Kodos is basically saying, like, I was almost like I was ordered to do it. I was part of a larger thing. So in a way, it was like not trying to excuse his.
But he's
action.
Again trying to cast himself in a different role there.
Right. He wasn't just like some, you know, maniacal twirling mustache guy going, I'm going to control the world. I'm going to kill everybody.
That's right. I did it. I did it all. Not that guy.
So maybe he did have some kind of trauma or regret or anything to where he would compartmentalize because once it's all revealed that, you know, she's been killing the survivors and witnesses, he says to both Kirk and the daughter, I was trying to keep that away from touching her. And so it's like that could lead into like saying build a whole other life, a whole other identity, and, you know, so much that he may believe it or, you know, in a way forget that other side of it.
Which I've had so many people tell me is kind of the role of the actor to be able or the reason that some people become actors, to become someone else, to not be who they are for a while and to get the chance to be someone better, someone worse, just someone different.
The reason I play role-playing games, perhaps not quite as high a calling, but it works.
Same difference.
One thing that I also really like, this is not really Shakespearean, but I really like that in this episode that when Kirk starts giving like weird orders that don't make sense, like I appreciate that Spock actually investigates them instead of just being like, oh, well, this episode, I know that you're just Kirk giving the orders and not, like, you know, a weird space alien pretending to be Kirk. Because that's always one thing about Star Trek that's bothered me a little bit, is that they have a number of episodes where the captain gets, like, impersonated across, like, the different series. But then they have other episodes where the captain just starts giving weird orders because they have their reasons. And I'm like, why are you guys not wondering if they've been impersonated this episode?
So yeah, you'd feel like that'd be something worth looking into.
So as a minor point, I appreciate that Spock was investigating that. We also get to hear Spock say, when McCoy is like, do you think he thinks this guy is Kodos? And Spock says, he'd better. Which is kind of a funny line for Spock.
Yeah.
Just like, go, Jim, you better have a good reason or you're going to be in so much trouble. So that was The Conscience of the King, and I really enjoy that episode. And that was the end of my list of Shakespeare and Star Trek, because, I, you know, again, there are all kinds of quotes, but those, I think, are the big ones where it's really about Shakespeare, right? Like, we're not just exchanging Shakespeare quotes. There are actual, like, really big themes of Shakespeare.
Well, so, thematically and character type wise, I feel like there's a lot more ground we could cover. So I'd love to be able to talk about this again when we can look into it further and maybe with more of the later series.
That's probably a good idea. David, do you have any closing thoughts in the original Klingon, perhaps?
Well, you know, since we're talking Shakespeare in general and then also with Star Trek, here's kind of one that goes to the more in general side of it, but also it's like not necessarily actually Shakespeare, but a derivative work or inspired by it. One of my favorite movies of all time, which is based on a book, I believe, is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Yes.
I just love that, the whole story. And
Tom Stoppard.
I like the idea, and we've seen that in certain novels of Star Trek or other things, where you take some minor characters and then kind of give them their story, give them a time to shine or their voice or more to them. So I liked that they did that. You know, those two characters are from Hamlet. But then just the actual dialogue, the movie, the story, everything of it, I just, you know, it's an absurdist, you know. And I like how they call it a tragicomedy. So it's, that was one of my favorite things about Shakespeare, but it's actually not from Shakespeare, but I love that. But just a quick little thing there about that.
And you mentioned that. It's actually interesting. I think The Lower Decks from TNG is very Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Like,
yeah,
it's very similar.
Agree with that.
So, you know, there are a couple of characters in there that we've seen as background characters, and then a few more that are new, but they're all like, you know, they're the lower ranks. That, and this is like, what do they see when the Enterprise is doing one of its like crazy, insane episode stories? Like, what does it look like to someone who isn't on the bridge all the time?
Well, and when they call that the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, they call it a tragic comedy. That kind of applies to Lower Decks because there's some more lighthearted moments in that episode. But then, I mean, Cito Jaxa, I mean, that's very tragic. So, but just a quick side thing, it was Chancellor Gorkon who in the Undiscovered Country said, "You have never experienced Shakespeare until you have read him in the original Klingon." That was, you know, kind of just a fun thing they put into the script. But the Klingon Language Institute took that ball and ran with it. And like I said, they've translated or restored the text of Hamlet into the Klingon language. And also they translated Much Ado About Nothing into Klingon. And then there's been several different, you know, theater companies that have done different Shakespeare works in Klingon on stage. And so it's just very cool that, you know, that continued on and, you know, you actually, well, because here's a side note on that. There was a documentary about the Klingon language called Earthlings. It was about the Klingon language in general, but it also was about how it was used in Star Trek and away from Star Trek. And they mentioned that the Klingon Language Institute translated Hamlet and other Shakespeare works. And Michael Dorn made a comment that he kind of didn't like that, because obviously the Klingon language is not as fully robust as a living language, and you know, certain words like when you mentioned the to be or not to be quote, instead of slings and arrows they use like torpedoes, because the idea being like a you know, that's the closest word they have is a missile or whatever.
That's interesting.
And he had
world
said
building wise though, you'd also like to think they've got their own sort of social equivalent of Hamlet.
Right, but from the real world perspective, Michael Dorn was like, he didn't like the idea of translating into Klingon because he felt that it would diminish Shakespeare, that you wouldn't have the same, you know, gravitas to it in a way, but also it seemed like he was also meaning like you wouldn't get the same, like, rhymes or the same, you know, lyrical almost quality to some of it. And I thought, well, hasn't Shakespeare been translated into other languages around the world, like French, Chinese, or whatever? So I think interpreting
big Latin even
Shakespeare and translating it, I think that's where you're going to lose some of Shakespeare's, you know, puns or wordplay or, you know, actual language, but then you're going to get the core themes to it. And I think that's something that really plays into like why Star Trek, among other, you know, there's all kinds of different sci-fi genre and works, fantasy, but I think it was really cool that over the years from TOS all the way up to Voyager, that Star Trek, you know, you would draw upon Shakespeare and, you know, take it to that level. And just to kind of, another thing in closing, I remember when, I always loved the quote, and I'm sure we've all heard it, where people would go to Patrick Stewart and say, like, you know, you are a Royal Shakespearean Company actor doing great works. Why are you, you know, putting on spandex and being space captain? And his response was all of the works he did in Shakespeare prepared him for the role of Captain Picard. And I always just thought that was a cool book, not like, oh yeah, yeah, I'm just slumming it or whatever. But so I just love it that Star Trek and Shakespeare are connected on so many levels.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And interestingly enough, Patrick Stewart as Macbeth is a really good show if you ever get a chance to see a recording of it. But thank you both for joining me on this discussion. A happy 450th birthday to the Bard himself. And we hope you join us next week. This will be All Things Trek, signing off.